And welcome to the Matthew Aaron Show. I am Matthew Aaron, www.thematthewaronshow.com, at Matt Aaron Show on Twitter, Matthew Aaron on Facebook, Matthew Aaron Show on Facebook. You can like it, as Caesar says, like it. It doesn't give you much of a choice. So we have a big show today. I'm going to introduce my two co-hosts in a second. And but I do want to tell everyone, Joe Carnahan from The Gray, which I can finally talk about, is going to be on this show. He's the director, writer of The Gray, and he's going to be on. He did Narc, he did Smoking Aces, he did The A-Team. Here's my co-host. Go ahead, Lee.
Lee Caprias, hello.
And my very special visiting from the city of Chicago, Julia McCrabass.
Julia Gray, actually.
Yeah. Oh, you're going to go by the real name today?
You know, I don't know. I'm kind of on the fence about it. I can't
well, it's
about
out there now.
I am a McCrabass.
McCrabass, so you're Irish.
I like McCrabass.
Yeah, I like it, too.
Like, even when I talk to, like, Dave Stone or like Lou or anything, yeah, I go,
Julia,
I was
McCrabass.
Talking to McCrabass the other day.
Yeah.
So, okay.
Oh, boy.
So here we are.
Fair-haired lass.
And Julia, why don't you explain for people, you've been on before, you were on when Peter was on, Peter mm-hmm. Schenck, and tell us about your background a little, you know, what would you know about Hollywood?
Oh, boy. Gosh. You could probably fit that on the head of a pin. Well, I started out working as an assistant film/video editor in Hollywood in animation and live action and TV. Stuff like that, and left. But I did work with Pete on The Dark Backward. I was his first assistant, and it was a joy. It was very fun. It was a hard job, but it was very, very fun. And probably the weirdest movie I've ever worked on.
Greatest.
But it was so much fun.
Actually sitting on our coffee table right now.
It's a good one.
It's center so end table right it's, now from
I've
Cinephile.
Cinephile had it. I haven't seen it in years.
Yeah, it's a good one. I haven't seen it.
Judd Nelson.
Yeah, Judd Nelson.
Did you do
Bill
any
Paxton?
Other Judd Nelson classics?
Yeah.
No.
Bill Paxton, that's
Bill
right.
Paxton. Yep, Bill Paxton, Wayne Newton.
Yeah, Wayne.
Lara Flynn Boyle.
Lara Flynn
so
Boyle,
why was it
cast.
Such a tough job to work on? Is it just because the budget?
It was a lot of work. The budget, a lot of footage, tight schedule. We had a production manager who was a bit of a dick. And then, you know, Pete was great, and the director, Adam Rifkin, is a great guy, and it was a fun time. It was like my first real job as a first on a feature, so it was a lot of learning. It was a huge
And last time
lesson.
We were on, we talked about your last time on a feature, which was The Breakup.
Yes, that was, in Chicago, and I was on that briefly, too. But
yeah.
Sinking Dailies.
So not your
fun.
Favorite film?
It was okay.
Yeah.
It was okay. I made Jennifer Aniston laugh because I swore, like,
yeah.
Longshoreman, which is easy, very easy for me to do. So
I only hear good things about her as a person.
She seems like a nice person.
That's
she laughed at me.
That's good enough for you.
Yeah.
She laughed at me.
Yeah, I was.
I fucking love her. All right, we're about to have Joe Carnahan on, and I'm really looking forward to this. Lee, why don't you, I did a rundown at the beginning, why don't you give your rundown of Joe and Joe's career and what the highlights are for you?
Okay.
Introduce our audience to Joe.
Okay. Joe is the director, to my knowledge, the A-Team, Smokin' Aces, and then before that was Narc with Jason Patrick and Ray Liotta. And his first movie, I believe it was 98 or 99, was called Blood, Guts, Bullets, and Octane. Which caused a stir because he was able to make it for a very low amount of money. I believe the number was $8,000 or something like that. And it's a tight little thing. He did a lot with very little. And so now, sort of first movie since A-Team, and Joe is also the writer. So he's a guy that does a lot with on production. And it's good to have him on.
We are sitting here with Joe Carnahan. Joe, how are you, sir?
I'm good. How are you guys doing?
Good, good.
The director and the writer of The Gray, I hear this, tell me if this is true off the bat.
Sure.
I hear this is a movie you've been working on and off for years, writing.
Yes,
that true?
That's true. I got the short story. I was on Mission Impossible 3 for like 15 months. This is back spring of 2003 to summer of 2004, and I was kind of winding up that little experience. And when I say winding up, I mean I was going to quit or they were going to fire me. So yeah. I kind of showed myself the door. And as that was kind of going on, I got this short story from a buddy of mine. It was just completely the opposite of what I was dealing with at the time. And I just, it really appealed to me. It's very, very spare, kind of stripped down survival story. So from there, I started to work on the script. And it took me, you know, like on and off 4 or 5 years to finally get it into shape where I was like, okay, I want to go make this film. And then it took another 3 years to actually get done.
Yeah, and, you know, you can tell the time and balance and quality you put into it. Because the script is so well balanced. I tell people this. I was just talking about it. Yeah, there's action, but there's dialogue, and there's also moments of atmosphere, and
right.
It's balanced so well.
I'm glad
how
you feel
you
that way,
do
brother.
That? How'd you do that? Because I write, and
right.
As a writer, you're always trying to find that balance, and it's just
sure.
hard.
Well,
you know?
It's tough because when you're dealing with a movie like this where there's a lot of things going on, you know.
Yeah.
Because, listen, if people show up just thinking, oh, I'm going to see a scary movie or I'm going to see a horror film, I'm going to see an action film, you'll get all that.
Yeah.
But the stuff that's going on in there that I'm really interested in, which is, you know, what do these guys do when they're kind of facing death, and what are the things that occur to them, what's going through their mind.
Right.
And it's tough because you don't want the film to stop cold so they can discuss this stuff. You always have to kind of keep the heat on. And it was a process, brother. It's hard, man.
Yeah.
It's like, listen, the good thing about the script was having the time that I had to write it. It wasn't like you go to a studio and it's like, all right, you got 12 weeks to get
yeah.
this thing done. You know, it wouldn't have been the same movie. In fact, I think it would have been a very hollow, ineffective movie. You know?
I thought the philosophical portions of the movie were outstanding. I've compared this movie to people I talked to William Friedkin's best work of the 70s. I thought there was
That's
a
brilliant, brother.
I thought it was great. I'm telling you, the philosophic. You made a ballsy movie. Open
yeah.
Road Films
yeah.
has represented here a ballsy movie.
Yeah.
Like, I'm not going to spoil anything, but even up until the last act. Like, just the
right.
movie has balls.
It has. The last act is where it really starts to get kind of deep, and I really appreciated that. Those scenes where they're talking are my favorite in the movie.
Yeah, right.
And the thrilling scenes are still very thrilling, but what they're talking about and how you made it, I think, is really, yeah, does show a bit of balls that I think a lot more movies could use.
I hope so, but I hope that, listen, you know, it's like, you know, I read some Jagoff reviewed it and said once it goes into the philosophical stuff,
review.
I thought, pal, and listen, it's like I look at those reviews and I'm thinking it looks like a 5-year-old kid whiffing at a birthday pinata. It's like you completely
yeah.
missed the point of the film.
Yeah.
And do you want these kind of endlessly empty experiences watching movies, or do you want something to play a lot longer for you than the 2 hours it takes to watch? And I think that's what I want. And I'm just, listen, I'm sick of going to films and walking, feeling like they just stole, you know, 50
yeah.
bucks for me, and I got nothing out of it.
There was two things. I read that review the other night. By the way, but like 85% of the reviews on Rotten Tomatoes are positive.
Right.
Some people really do get the movie.
Right.
Well, the guys that get it are like the Rex Reeds and the Peter Travers and like
yeah.
the critics that actually are meaningful to me.
Yeah.
They get the movie.
And
you know?
I, at the end of this movie, this third act's so great. At the end of this movie, the thing for me was I turned to Lee and I go, that is the best ending I've seen in a year.
Right.
Oh, that's great, man.
That's
great,
the best ending I've seen all year.
I was sitting there.
I was so happy.
I was sitting there and there was a moment where I'm like, this is where the movie should end, right here.
That's
and
crazy.
It ended.
Well,
that's
you
great.
Saw me. What
right.
was I
right.
doing? I was leaning forward
yeah.
and I'm like, I'm leaning forward in my seat. I'm fucking right. jacked, man.
Yeah, right. See, that's the thing, man. I feel like, you know, the guy, and it's you got to decide for yourself, I guess, in that moment. Is this a movie about a guy living and dying or a guy fighting a fucking wolf?
Love
and
it.
I, and
right.
I think. It was
living
like it was. It, now, did you guys stay to the very end after the credits? Did you see the little beat after the credits?
No.
Oh, there's a little.
I thought we stayed for the credits.
I don't know if we did.
No, bro. There's a small, tiny little thing after the credits. That's okay. I'm trying to figure out a way
go.
I can take
okay.
12 bucks from you.
Yeah. Now you did. You did. Now I gotta go. now I gotta go Friday. I gotta tell you, Joe. You have done some great work. You are a true. And I told Lee this the other day. You're a true auteur in my mind.
That's great, bro.
You're great. And
could you tell my mom that? Because, Jesus.
You are the one guy that doesn't seem to take shit from studios and people that are trying to collaborate on your projects that don't know what the hell they're talking about.
Right.
And there's something to be said for that. But how do you do it? How do you get away with it, man?
Bro, listen, you know, I always kind of, and I think we all do this, and sometimes it's like, I'm not, listen, there's so much shit I know nothing about and so much that, that scares the hell out of me and that I'm massively insecure about. I started writing when I was 14, 15 years old. You know what I mean? And so there's a lot of things I don't know, but the thing I do know will always bail me out. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like, I feel like it's like a guy who picked up a guitar when he's 3. By the time he's 40, he should know how to play the fucking guitar.
Right.
So I just look at it like a, that it's a, I don't ever, I, you know, I never wanted to, and listen, we could sit here, I could tell you stories about my time on Mission Impossible 3. A lot of them are hysterical because they're just so crazy. But I never felt that, I don't like the idea of backing down or ceding to, especially this town, man.
Yeah,
it's
man.
Like, I don't care enough about it to, you know, listen, I care about the work and the
right.
people I work with and the people I form relationships with, the perception of who I am beyond, listen, the idea that people thought, oh, this guy just does the A-Team and he does just does movies like that, this is an answer to that. It's like nobody does one thing anymore, brother, than you write one kind of thing. I think it's incredibly limiting. And I've always said, I'll use a baseball analogy. I always wanted to be the guy, I can hit leadoff, I'll hit cleanup, I'll play center field, I'll hit utility, whatever. I want to be able to do all those things. And the guys I admire, the Coen brothers, Steven Soderbergh, these are the guys that make movies. They never repeat themselves.
Right.
Right.
You know?
That's something that I think when I hear the term auteur, because I think a lot of people believe an auteur is someone who has this definitive style and puts a personal stamp on his movies, like Stanley Kubrick. You can always tell it's their movie.
Right.
But what I think is that he's an auteur is that every movie that that person kind of director makes is different in tone, different in style, different in content, and I think that's what makes an auteur. Is being able to bring your style to any genre.
Now, the A-Team...
Right, I think that's great, Lee. You're absolutely right, bro.
Yeah,
you're absolutely right.
Yeah.
You know?
The A-Team is actually playing right this moment on HBO. Some fans
is it
are
really?
Sending in some tweets and stuff about
I'd
it.
I'd love to hear. What do they have to say?
You know, here's the thing I was going to ask you. I think it just started, but here, 19 minutes ago. It's 1:19. But here's what I wanted to know. That movie was... You got some criticism from not just critics... Critics weren't that harsh on you. It was bloggers.
Right.
How do you deal with stuff like that, man? Because you're an opinionated guy and you're not going to put up with shit. But
I mean, listen, you know, here's what happens. I wind up, and I always tell myself, quit going on those sites, quit reading that shit. It just, you know, listen, because literally, ultimately, I feel like, you know, I read this kind of this review that took me to task, and I realized this guy doesn't like me. It has nothing to do with the movie. He doesn't like me. And he's saying how bad a writer I am. And I said to him, this guy writes for Box Office Magazine. Basically what I wanted to say is, pal, when you make as much money writing as I do, then I'll listen to what you have to say.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you get caught up in that shit. There's a great line from The Untouchables where De Niro at the end, or during the movie, says to Costner, if you were a man, you would have done it by now. And that's how I feel. It's like, you want to go out and lay out and do your own thing? It rarely happens. You get a guy like Rod Lurie, who I have tremendous
love
respect
Rod.
For.
Rod's our buddy.
Show,
Rod's great.
Buddy of mine.
Yeah. Rod's great. By the way, in addition to being a great filmmaker, there's a guy that, like, somebody, you know, he called himself out. It's like, I'm going to be a film critic? No, fuck it. I'm going to go make movies. I love that. It doesn't happen often
He's
enough.
A man of principle.
We
talked about that before the show, Rod Lurie, and how he had the balls to... He was a flame-throwing film critic.
Absolutely.
He told it like it was in his mind, and then he said, I'm going to make movies. And some... I've had Rod on the show. Rod's a friend of mine. I consider him, and you know, we've hung out, and he just talks
Rod.
About like, you know, he had troubles with actors not liking him, or certain critics not liking him.
Sure.
And he lives with that backlash. And
you have to, bro.
And
listen,
he just doesn't give a shit.
You know what? Here's the thing. Here's what I'll say about take a movie like Smoking Aces, which just got, you know, kind of they savaged it, and I think they savaged. I think it's a massively misunderstood film. But when I had a guy that purported to hate the film. And then said to me, it does not come on and I don't sit and watch it to the end. I was like, well, dude, then that's not on me, man. That's on you. Like, you have to decide why the film, what that means to you.
Right.
And I feel the same thing. I knew I was in trouble when I read a Roger Ebert review of The A-Team. And he took me to task citing Newtonian law. It's like, asshole, I know a tank won't fly. Are we doing Shakespeare in the Park or the fucking A-Team? I'm sorry that I've somehow trampled this hallowed ground.
I agree with that. A-Team was, first of all, it was a ridiculous show to begin with on purpose. It was supposed to be over the top.
Right. Exactly. And you know what? My wife is Scottish. She grew up loving that show. And I can honestly say, hand on heart, 50% of the reason I did that movie was for her. The other 50% is, I got bills to pay, baby. You know, it's like,
yeah,
but
right.
But listen, I still had a blast doing that movie, and I think it's that movie's a hell of a lot of fun if you watch it with the right frame of reference.
And what's great though is I think it all worked out regardless. If that movie made 500 mil, you're making 18-2-3.
Brother,
the gray
1,000%. So, yeah. And I wouldn't have wanted to do that, and I think it would have been very limiting to do that. And you're right, I wouldn't have made the gray.
Yeah, and let's talk about the gray bit. So you worked with Liam Neeson on the A-Team, and that was your guys' first time working together. Did that lead you to want to work with him for the gray, or did you want to work with him on the gray even before A-Team?
Well, you know what happens, I think, Matt, is that you get to a point in your career where it becomes about, you know, and I'm 40 now, and it's like you get to a point where it's like, I don't want to work with assholes, man. I want to work with people. It's about quality of life and quality of experience. And,
yeah.
And you get a guy like Liam, and, you know, it's funny. We were sitting in a restaurant. We were on the A-Team promotional tour, and I was sitting in a restaurant in London talking to the producer about different actors we were going to on the gray, and Liam happened to overhear the conversation and said, you know, in his very understanding, wait, mate, do you think there's anything then for me? You know, I said, of course there is. So we talked, and it was one of those things where it just caught fire, man. He read it. He read the screenplay and flipped out and wanted to do it. And when you have a situation like that with a guy that gets a movie made at a price, you have to leap at it, man. It's so goddamn difficult to make a film under any circumstances to get that situation the way we had it. We had to act on it. And listen, thank God, because I can't imagine anybody playing that role now. The guys I was considering at the time, and even someone like, you know, Bradley Cooper for a while, was talking.
Sure.
And to Cooper's credit, man, the guy comes up to me at the premiere sobbing and gives me the biggest hug. And he actually told one of the actors, thank God I wasn't in that. And, you know, for a guy to say that without any ego tells you, like, how great a dude Cooper really is, because he just let it go.
That's
he didn't
great.
He just let it go.
That's awesome. And, you know, I've been telling people, you know, this is not – Liam's done some great work, and he's been doing more action movies as of late. But this isn't Taken. And
no.
This is an unknown.
No.
This is a great action movie, but not in the way you're suspecting. I mean, this has some, like – in a weird way, there's like an Elmore Leonard even kind of vibe to it at parts.
Brother.
You know, man?
That's interesting,
like,
yeah.
There is just this dark, like, but well, I love the religious stuff that happens in
right.
it, too.
Yeah.
I love that. No one has not had that moment Liam Neeson has in the
no
third
question,
act.
Man.
Yeah.
No one.
I think, and I don't know how you guys felt about it, but there's a, you know, it's funny, I got this question where that moment that you're talking about, this kind of Liam's kind of rant to the heavens, and I had
right.
a number of people say to me,
that was great.
I thought a helicopter was going to show up in between those trees. And
I know.
Thought, my God, if I had done that to you, you should have literally flamethrowed my house, me.
Yeah.
Like, but
love that
some,
you feel that way.
And some woman literally said to me, she was convinced, I mean, like, adamantly, like, you put the sound of a helicopter on that soundtrack. I heard it.
If there was, I heard something during that scene, you can hear. Right?
No,
well,
I didn't put anything on there,
no.
Man.
Joe, I think what
he was kind of losing his mind.
There's a lot of atmospheric noises from being where they are with the snow. Oh, my God. And by the way, how did you shoot these scenes with all the snow, the blizzard and shit?
Bro, that
what
was,
a fucking scene.
That was shot in the actual conditions. None of that shit you see at the beginning is faked. I mean, that was like, we got hit with 70-mile-an-hour winds once.
That's
you know?
Awesome.
And it's like, you guys are all Chicago. You know how cold it can get. And with the wind, you know exactly how cold it can get. This was unlike anything I'd ever experienced. We had the coldest day we had was minus 37 degrees.
Oh, wow.
And when you get that with 70-mile-an-hour winds, you are fucked.
Liam standing there with no gloves and a cardigan or something.
Yeah.
You know?
No, and you know, if you guys see that, when he sits up out of the snow post-crash, you
yeah.
see that there's a color in his face that you can't, there's no makeup in the world that can create that.
Yeah.
That is literally because Noriko Watanabe, his makeup artist, who's married to Sam Neill, the very fine Dr.
Yeah.
Alan Grant.
Yeah,
he's
great.
Right.
Sam Neill's great.
Noriko's amazing, and Noriko and I were picking up handfuls of snow and throwing them in Liam's face, and it was like, he was sitting there taking it, and everybody kept saying, you can't put them in the snow, you can't put them in the snow. So
great.
That stuff is all real, man.
Tell me if I'm crazy at thinking this. Liam Neeson has a very Roy Scheider-like quality to him.
Right.
Bro, absolutely.
You think?
Absolutely.
Okay, I'm not crazy.
He's like the European Roy Scheider.
In the past few weeks, we've watched at home Sorcerer.
Friedkin, that's such a great movie.
And 52 Pickup.
Another great movie. Yeah. Another Frankenheimer. That was Frankenheimer.
Getting our non-Jaws Roy Scheider.
Yeah.
On.
Yeah.
And, like, this guy was like a classic movie star. Just like a guy who went out and did what he
about
had
the
to do.
Like the Seven Ups, man. I mean, yeah, it was
I was talking about the Seven Ups. I love the Seven Ups.
52 Pickup is fantastic. Sorcerer's great. Sorcerer's such a that scene on the bridge when they're trying to, like, and, you know, it's a remake of Wages of Fear. It's so good.
That's what I compared this movie to. Wages of Fear and the Sorcerer.
That's great.
When I told Lee, when I left, it has that vibe, man.
Yeah, right.
You're always on the edge of your seat, but it's not like there's a bad guy. Like, there's not Dennis Hopper walking around and he's going to shoot you.
No, exactly.
You know, it's not. There's always this vibe that they're in danger, but instead of nitroglycerin being on the trucks, it's wolves surrounded by a pack of wolves.
Right.
Yeah, it's funny, man, that where I think that works most succinctly, where it works really well, is the Diaz death scene, when this guy kind of concedes. And at the end, there's this kind of, and the camera's very still.
That scene was great.
It's the best.
I wouldn't ruin it, but there's a scene in the movie where a character chooses his own future. That's what I put it. And
but that shot was beautiful.
And you let that scene play out. You just gave it some time. It's just kind of, and the way you filmed it, it was just sort of like a reverse. The guy's just to the guy's back, and almost. It was. I thought that was really good. And I was pretty curious to ask if you storyboarded at all for this. Because
you know, brother,
some of the things have the feel of being, you know, like. They have to be in a certain place in your composition.
That's a good question.
You know what? I mean, in that scene that you're talking about, Lee, I literally told Frank Grillo, the actor, and I think Frank is at
awesome.
The breakout
awesome.
Performance for this guy.
Yep.
I told him, it's like, bro, listen, you have to understand, I'm going to shoot this in an almost tableau style. I'm not going to come in there and get close, because I think at this point in the film, we are voyeurs, man. We don't belong in this little trifecta of men talking about what's going to happen. So, and I think it's a 9-minute, or no, it's like an 8.5-minute scene with 9 cuts in the whole scene. But I storyboarded as much as I looked through the, you know, the viewfinders. We're here, and we're here, and that's it. And what I think, though, that actually really works well about that scene, and what I love watching is when you see it with an audience, everybody's so insecure at that point about what's going to happen. When that camera starts to creep in on his back, you see people start to cover their eyes because they think Wolf's going to dart in there and rip this guy up. And that's what's great, is that it unsettles you to the point where you don't feel safe,
right.
You know?
There's two actors I want to talk about, but I also want to say I did get an email a couple minutes ago, a couple of them. People are comparing it also to Deliverance.
That's great. That's
they're
a huge...
making a Deliverance
absolutely,
comparison.
Man. I had everybody, the entire cast, read that book before we started. They all read Deliverance, James Dickey.
That's
which,
great.
If you've not read the book is probably better than the movie, and the movie's great.
The movie's great, yeah. The movie's so haunting and effective. It's almost like you can't watch it twice.
No.
It's hard.
No, it's really hard.
I thought it was going to be a lot like The Edge, and I thought it was more
I
thought it was more like Deliverance and like Wages of Fear than it was The Edge.
Yeah, and it had that great... Who are some of the guys that have influenced you and inspired you? Because I'm getting a freaking vibe.
Sure.
I got a little Walter Hill coming in there.
Sam Peckinpah.
Yeah, Peckinpah.
You talked about some of your influences on the DVD extras for Narc. Friedkin was kind of an influence in that.
Oh, Friedkin was huge. When I met Billy Friedkin, it was like he actually said to me, because he was such a huge Narc fan, he said, I wish I knew how to make that kind of movie now. You know, and I thought,
great movie.
God, this is like Billy Friedkin, who, by the way, to me, something... You know, post To Live and Die in L.A., this idea that you would kill Bill Peterson at the end of that.
That's great.
And then John Pankow, who you barely know, you go the rest of the film with him. I thought that was fucking inspiring.
And that's how I feel about this movie. This ending has that kind of ball.
Right.
It's great.
I just hope, man, I think my fear is, you guys are obviously, you know, love movies and are sophisticated. You know, you know what you like in a movie.
Right.
And I wonder, in a mass audience way, will that work?
We were with some mainstream
audience people.
We're
real
people.
Sophisticated.
Well,
you guys are motherfucking sophisticated.
Yeah. We watch Three Stooges every night before.
Every 4
Dude,
days.
By the way, the Stooges, you know what's
if
funny?
If we had a bad day.
Someone said this to me, you will never see so distinctly the difference between men and women as if you put Three Stooges on. Women go, this is retarded.
Yeah.
And the guy can't stop laughing.
I will stick up for it. My mother and my sister are the only two women I know who like the Stooges.
Yeah, my wife does too. My wife loves the Stooges.
Oh, lucky you. My mom hates it. I wanted to say, though, like, this movie, it just... I can't speak highly enough about it.
That's
I love
great,
it.
Brother.
I want to ask you about Dallas Roberts.
Yes.
Because I thought that was an inspired casting choice.
Yeah.
He's great on The Good Wife.
Right.
Which I watch. That's the only TV show on network that I watch.
You know,
and
it's funny. My younger brother loves that show,
great
too.
Great show. Matthew, who's the writer.
Yes.
Matthew Carnahan, who's a great writer.
Fantastic. Better writer than me, dude. Great writer.
Great. and he likes The Good Wife. So Dallas is on there, and he's great. But this role was different for him, and he's great in it.
Dallas has this great sensitivity about him, and this great, and you know, it's so crazy. Everybody was like, "Oh, is Dallas gay? Is that because his demeanor?" And he's not.
Wow.
He's straight as an arrow. He's got a wife and two kids. But it's great because it's funny. He always says this about himself too. He always gets like glad. We'll always contact him and talk about, you know. But he is. Dallas has this great sense of, and again, I cast all those guys knowing how, having a feeling of how they're going to play off one another. But I just didn't want it also to be these overly masculine dudes that were just full of shit. You know,
right.
You had to have a mix of people, and I think they're symbolic, I guess, of Otway in a certain way. The part of him that's sensitive, the part of him that's naive, the part of him that's macho, all that stuff. But Dallas is extraordinary, man. There's very little, and I cast him literally. He did a 2.5-minute scene for me, and I saw that, and then he got the role.
So did you see him before that in anything? Or?
I saw him in 310 to Yuma, which I loved him in. He was in.
Yeah.
He was even in. He was in Walk the. Is it Walk the Line or Walk the Line?
Walk the Line. Yeah.
I thought he was great. So I've been a fan of Dallas, and a fan of all these guys for a long time. I remember seeing Joe Anderson in The Crazies. I loved him in that.
I was going to ask you about James Badgedale and Dermot Mulroney too, and what made you decide these are my guys, especially Dermot Mulroney, which I thought was an inspired casting choice.
What's great about D is when you see the movie, and some people literally
himself.
They don't even know who the hell he is until the very end when he takes his glasses off to go across the chasm. They're not even aware that's
right.
Dermot.
Right.
So it's like So it's like I think Dermot just embraced this idea that he didn't want to look like the guy in My Best Friend's Wedding, and so he went, man. He went all the way. With Badge. I'd been such a fan of Badge's for a long time. And it's funny, I got to see my brother show me a little bit of the work he did in World War Z.
Yeah.
And Badge has this ability to do a lot of things really beautifully. And I've just been a fan, man.
Yeah, he opens up the movie.
Totally.
Like, and he gets you really into it.
Well, he's the thesis statement on the film. He really is. He's the scene that shows you, it's like, okay, this is what, and I hope when you watch that movie, this is post-crash. That when that scene happens with him and Liam, you know, oh, okay, this is the movie I'm in.
Yeah, this is the real deal at that point. Someone I was talking to, I said, what's the deal here? Because I think if this film was released last month, it's an Oscar contender.
That's great,
no bullshit.
Brother, I'll tell you, here's the thing. Two things. One, I wasn't happy with the way, and you guys have seen the film. You know how important sound is in this movie. It's critical. I mean, it's another character.
It's like Seven. It's as good as Seven with the sound, where you shut off your eyes and you know everything that's going on.
You know stuff that's happening. So one, I wasn't happy with where the mix was, and to kind of start the award season, it's kind of necessary that you go to Toronto Film Festival. So we didn't make that, and I wasn't content to kind of say, oh, let's just whatever. It's more important we get the movie in Toronto. I wanted to remix the film, so I brought it back here to L.A. and had my guys, Craig Hennigan, who worked on the A-Team, and this great mixer, Andy Koyama, remix the whole thing. We redid the sound, we redid everything. So we weren't prepared, and I also didn't want to feel like we're forcing it into, let's just open it in December. But the second thing is, to Open Road's credit, they have promised, they have guaranteed us an October reminder campaign. They're going to re-release the film in October.
That's awesome.
That's assuming it doesn't come out and do $5. If it does $5, it's going to be a little tough. But
I don't want to jinx anything, but I've already... Mike Binder, who owns Detroit Coney Dog here
absolutely.
On West Sunset.
I'm a Michigan guy, so
you.
I can't
he
believe this.
You.
That's great, man.
We were talking about NARC yesterday and how it's a Detroit-set movie. And Mike and I are huge fans of your work. And he cannot wait to see this movie.
Oh, that's great, man.
He is
that's
on
great.
The edge of his
Binder's a really talented director as well. He really is.
Fantastic.
Man. He really is.
Yeah, he's getting back to work now on stuff, which is great. But I got to tell you, like, I'm talking to him, and I'm like, this movie's so good. I think it's going to open really well. And I think people are going to be blown away. I think if the rest of the movies this year are anywhere near the league of this, you are setting off the year right.
That's great, brother.
You're setting
I
it
hope
off.
So, because you know what? If it doesn't, the part of me will be like, all right, we've devolved somehow in our viewership. We don't know how to watch movies anymore. And I hope that's not the case.
I hope
do.
Not, too.
Right.
I hope not, too. I'm really... oh man, I'm really hoping they play. I have an interesting question for you. When are we going to see a Joe Carnahan comedy? Because I'm a comedy writer. I like to act, right. But I don't know if I could do the Gray.
Brother,
I'd
know
love
what?
To do a Joe Carnahan movie.
I will give you the guy in the Gray that dies first.
I will say it right here on your show. I will give you a role in a thing that I wrote, a thing that I'm actually going to take out probably next week called Stretch. And
yeah.
it's basically, remember After Hours?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's After Hours in L.A. with a limo driver. And
oh,
it's 100% cool.
Wow.
Comedy.
That could be great.
And it's really fucking funny.
So it's Collateral without the killing.
Exactly.
That's
Collateral without
great.
Jamie Foxx, the killing, or the Michael Mann. Yeah.
I really want to see a Joe Carnahan comedy. I don't know why.
I'd love to do it, man. You know, listen, you know what, dude,
like
you know this.
A really great dude, open, honest.
Right.
And that's what you need for comedy.
Well, it's funny. I think that there are guys like, you know, obviously Todd Phillips does it brilliantly. I'm a big fan of Nick Soler, who did Get Them to the Greek. It's like there's guys that can do it really well. And I think to go in and do a straight out kind of comedy like this, I've never written anything like Stretch, but I think it's really funny.
Yeah.
To me it's funny. But I'd love to do it, and the fact that it's set in LA and I could sleep in my own bed at night would be really nice. But again, I don't know how much external pressure I'm gonna feel now to go and do Pablo Escobar, White Jazz, you know.
Tell me about Pablo Escobar. This is something also you've been working on for years.
Well, I mean, listen, the film is green lit, I just have to decide when I want to do it. And I'd love to do it this year, but again, it means travel. And, you know, I haven't seen my wife and kids enough, and I'd like to kind of like, I don't want, you know, my son's going to be a freshman in high school next year.
You don't
and I
want
to kind of, I don't
want
to miss all. I don't want to look up and go, because, you know, listen, nobody ever ends their life going, I wish I'd worked more. You know what I mean?
Yeah, right.
So it's like, and I've given my kids like all these cameos in my movies just because of my considerable failings as a father. I can at least say, honey, look what dad did for you. Don't ever say I didn't love you.
Yeah, one thing we're learning since we moved out here is, boy, the personal life really falls by the wayside. We expected as much, but, like, immediately the onset of, boy, you got to just keep working. And how do guys have wives and kids?
Yeah. No, I think it's different, man. It's like you guys are Midwestern guys. You get the view. I think you understand the value of, like, personal relationships. And out here, it's kind of disposable shit. It's like, you know,
right.
You know,
unfortunate.
The other reason I brought up the comedy thing is you did Smoking Aces, which had a definitely dark comedy sense to it,
right?
And it's great. It's fun that way. It's a fun movie.
Yeah.
And my thing was, I've been developing this script with Mike, and we're pitching it and stuff, and I'm like, I want to make ballsy choices. I want to get someone who hasn't done it that could, like, that kind of, and you did that, I think, with casting with that movie.
Right.
Talk about why you casted some of the actors like Affleck or Alicia Keys or what made you go outside the box and go, these are my guys.
Yeah, the contrarian in me likes to go against the grain and kind of cast against type, you know. When I did that, you know, Ryan Reynolds had never played any kind of a serious role. He was the guy in Just Friends, and he was the comedy guy. So, in the same way with Chris Pine, you know, Pine had never, you know, Pine kind of had a moment in that film, the way Bateman did. You know, Bateman says to this day, it's like, I owe you my career, because it's suddenly, you know, after Smoking, it's like the 2.5 minute Oscar. Somebody said, the guy's got the 2.5 minute Oscar. But I just, listen, I mentioned earlier, there's a lot of things I don't do well. I think I have a good eye for casting, a good eye for kind of
Bateman
putting people
was
together.
A great choice.
Bateman's fantastic.
Great.
And Affleck, as soon as Ben read it and thought, I'd die in the first 15 minutes, the idea, and he told me, I've never died in a film and I've never been squibbed in a movie. So I thought, well, this is
gotta
fantastic.
Be so much fun.
Yeah. But I gotta tell you, I think you casting Bateman in that movie led Bateman to being cast in State of Play, which was phenomenal.
Which my brother wrote.
Is that true, or am I crazy about that?
You know what? I don't know, but it's possible. I mean,
think
listen,
Bateman showed some things in Smoking Aces that were very comparable to the character in State of Play.
It's funny. This is what I'd like to see Bateman do more. I want to see him do that guy more because you know what? He's
awesome.
A great straight guy. He's an even better wild card. He really
is. I agree.
He's really funny,
dude. You put the nail on the head. Wild card, not dramatic, not comedy. He is the wild card.
He is, and you know what? He also makes the actors around him better. I mean, if you watch that scene of Smoking Aces, there's moments where Affleck and Pete Berg turn away from camera because they're losing it.
Yeah.
I mean, they're losing it because he's so good. All that bones it, all that stuff he did is him. That's Bateman. Just being, you know, available in the moment and having fun.
That's great. So for our listeners who are tuning in because they're like, wow, The Gray and Liam Neeson, maybe they're not totally familiar with all your stuff.
Right.
Let's talk about NARC for a moment.
Sure.
I just like relaying these type of stories. Talk about how you got involved in the business, how you got in the business, and
right.
talk about what it took to make NARC and why you got it made where you got it made, which is Toronto and Detroit, right?
Right. Yeah. Well, I mean, listen, I've made a very small film before that called Blood, Guts, Bullets, and Octane.
Right.
It cost
yeah.
like $8,000. We went to Sundance with it, right? And so that immediately kind of pigeonholes you as this guy. So I'd had the script for NARC, and it's nothing like what Blood, Guts, Bullets, and Octane was. So it took me 3 years to kind of, you know, get that film made. And no, and I remember I had an offer. I think it was the director, Mark Pellington, who I was basically being offered to step down if he could direct it and that they would make the movie. And
yeah.
I couldn't do it because I knew how important it was to me and how good a piece of writing it was to me. So I kind of held fast, and God bless Ray Liotta, my very dear friend who I'm going to do this thing with, you know. And he said, I want to do it. And I think we got $3-4 million to do the film, and Ray got...
He's fantastic.
Ray got the movie made, and
right.
it was one of those... And, you know, again, we went to Toronto, and I think we shot that movie in 29 days, and then went to Detroit. And in Detroit, specifically, we had this lieutenant with us, this guy Ken, who was... Eminem's main security guy at the time, and I remember he gave Jason his gold detective shield, and I shot from a van, long lens, and Jason walked up to real people on the street and started badging him, and all that
wow.
stuff, the montage and art, that's all real. But you're going for this degree of authenticity. It was very difficult, but then after that, you're everybody's best pal. And it's funny, I'm experiencing the same moment that I had after NARC right now, where suddenly these people that didn't give a shit.
Everyone's
give
jumping
a shit.
On the Joe bandwagon.
The difference is at 40 or whatever, you know the difference between, okay, now everybody wants to be your buddy.
Yeah.
And it's fine. I get it, man. Listen, I'm not going to sit here and bitch about that. That's just the condition of being in Hollywood. You guys are obviously making
yeah.
that very painful discovery.
Well, yeah, right. Well, with Blood, Guts,
yeah.
Bullets, and Octane, that was a movie that I showed to all my friends. I remember when we were living in, it was like five of my
yeah.
indie rock friends living in the
right.
London Square neighborhood. And this is back when I had this idea when I thought I could be a filmmaker. I think it would be a terrible one. But I'm like, this is something that I think this guy is like, we could make something this way. Because it doesn't matter if you don't have any money. If you have dialogue and,
yes.
and a good plot, you can do something like this.
So right.
Did so much with so little.
Yeah, tell me the truth, Joe. If you could use today's cameras for your first
it,
film, it wouldn't have been even $8,000. It
right.
would have been like $5,000.
No, it would have been
grand.
Mad. And, you know, I always say this to young filmmakers coming up. It's like, listen, it's like, well, they're like, well, everybody's making a movie now. I said, listen, guys, the cream still rises to the top.
Yeah.
Right.
And I think that you have this, nobody has an excuse anymore because you can get a Canon 5D, which I shot on The Gray and used quite a bit. And it looks as professional, as great as anything. You can get great sound, and you can cut it all on a Mac, and it doesn't cost anything. So I think there's no excuse now. If you want to go make a feature film, and you have the wherewithal to do it, it can be done for not a lot of money.
Right.
Yeah. So let me ask you this, personal advice-wise. All right, I have a meeting after this. I got to shoot to Comedy Central for a 3 o'clock meeting.
Right.
How do you pitch as a guy that's a filmmaker? When you go into these pitches... How do you pitch? What is your thing?
I mean, my thing is, man, I hate pitching.
Yeah.
I mean, I hate it. I think
sucks.
It's like somebody, like, you know, like it's like throwing you a top hat and a cane, and it's like, go
right.
do your thing. Dance around.
Right.
Dance for me, monkey. Dance. And I hate that shit. So oftentimes I'll go in, what I'll do is I'll cut like a little, scene together. And I sold this thing to Showtime, and I showed them the plane crash from The Gray, and I said, that's how I want the whole
wow.
show to be. So for me, it's kind of a bullshit. It's like a get-out-of-jail-free card. But you know what I think it is? It's like, listen... They respond to enthusiasm first and foremost, and if you just move, and if you just tell the story, don't get caught up in a lot of
yeah.
stuff. Don't get because you're going to get questions. But listen, these people are paid to play everything very close to the vest, and they're never going to show you their cards.
Yeah,
right.
And you can and listen. I walked out when I sold Showtime. I walked out thinking that was pretty good, and we sold it an hour later. So you never know, man.
Wow.
So there's no, you know what? I hate it, dude. That's my
yeah.
I hate it. And you know what? Anything you can do to mitigate it.
I'm not
I
looking
that.
Forward to this at all. And Mike Binder was saying to me yesterday, he goes, you going to wear a suit? I go, no, Mike. No.
By the way, bro, they don't want you to wear a suit.
Yeah, I don't think you should about that.
Right.
He might glance. He goes, you don't own any suits anyway.
But what I would tell you this, what I'd say this, Matt, I think very important, just be yourself.
Yeah, man.
If you try to go in there and bullshit around or try to do something else, you won't be happy. It'll fail.
Yeah, I mean, I'm interested in this whole process and everything, but you can't bank on things, your meetings, whatever. You can't bank on this being the thing. You gotta spread your wealth a little, man, and you have to spread your work out. When you write, how do you balance directing a film and writing your project? Because I find as a writer, I can only write one script at a time.
Right.
Now, how do you do it?
See, the thing is, dude, I've gotten, you know, because I'm like an old man now, so it's like I've been able to, over this past, as I've been writing, I think screenwriting has gotten, I've grasped the concept. This is why I don't have any cool hobbies like play guitar or have a stamp collection. I can write, you know, so I stick to that. So what I do is, I'm able to kind of compartmentalize at times what I'm writing. It's still difficult, dude. So once you got your head in something, it's really hard to get out. But I'm writing this thing now, rewriting this thing now called Continue. And it's essentially Groundhog Day, like an action movie.
Oh, I love that.
Right? And it's very funny and very cool. But it's really what I found is that the deeper I've gotten into it, the harder it is for me to pull myself out and write something else.
Yeah.
But I think it's, you know, dude, it's, you should look at it like it's a necessary skill. Just teach yourself to be able to divorce yourself and move into another, you know, but move into another, whatever genre you're doing.
Yeah.
And I think also, I can't stress this enough, man, write your own shit and control your own shit.
Yeah.
The only
yeah.
thing we have in this town, man, is autonomy and the ability to, like, you know, Neil Blomkamp's a good buddy of mine. He did District 9.
Yeah.
And he just did a film called Elysium with Matt Damon. You know, Neil owned that thing, man. He wrote it with his wife, Terry. They own it. It's like, so that's, you know, the idea
District
that was...
District 9 was
great. Oh, it's great.
It was good.
It's great. So, but the idea that's like, there's like a pittance, like we're not getting what we ultimately deserve.
Yeah.
You guys are writers. You're a comedy writer. That's gold, dude.
Yeah.
It's even more gold when you own it.
Well, I've been writing feature screenplays since I was 14, and you were saying you were 14. So that connected with me. But I was telling Lee last night, because he just started really getting into the writing. He really got the writing bug for screenplay.
Great, bro. It's
and
great.
I told him I wrote a screenplay or two a year for the first 13 years. So I'm 28 now. Until last year, until I wrote this one that I'm doing, you know, working on with Mike. Until I wrote this one, they sucked. They weren't good. So you started at 14. How many of the ones were bad up until...
I can tell you this. I can tell you that Narc was the 16th or 17th feature-length script I had written.
Wow.
The other 14, 15 I put into a box, dude.
Right.
And that's what you do.
I buried my first script in the backyard of my house.
But you know what? That's what you do. I remember finishing one. I remember I wrote a script called Buddy Boy, and I remember finishing it and literally throwing it in my closet and starting another one because I thought, this is like... And you know what? You're right around the same age where I made my first film. So it's like...
Yeah.
You've taught yourself all this, it will not be for naught. But I can only tell you, I can only encourage you, keep cranking and keep going.
Yeah,
you know?
There's this thing. He's teaching himself. I had to teach myself writing is something not easy.
Well, it's
to
that thing
teach.
Where you have to accept the fact that you're not going to be on top of everything and make all the money immediately. If it means to be able to have control of your own shit, if it means doing a movie every 4 years versus every year. To get the work done the way you want it, so be it. You got to accept that.
Exactly.
If you want to be iconoclastic and have work that you don't not care about.
No, and you know, you guys are coming from a day and age. When I was your age, it was like the whole thing was like you were the hip guy if you had a two-picture deal at Universal. You're writing a script. And what you realize is, that's all fine and good. But unless you're making, you know, Todd Phillips made $35 million on The Hangover. You know why? Because he kicked in all of his fee, and they did it for no money, and they bet on the come, and that's what you have to do. You have to bet on yourself. And so many people are willing to take short-end money and give themselves over to a process that at the end of the day does not pay you a fraction of what it's worth.
Yeah.
So it's like you have to decide, and I would tell you guys both this, and Lee, in particular you, you're just getting kind of bit with the bug. As much as you can write your own stuff, trade it off, man. You write one for them at the same time you're writing one for you. You have to do that. That'll give you the artistic sense that you need to kind of carry on and be true to your craft, and it'll put money in your pockets
so
you pay your bills.
Right.
Yeah.
So
well,
Cassavetes was appearing in movies and using the money he made from that to make his own movies.
It's a great
analogy,
dude.
And some of the movies he was in are not that good.
No.
He's in
no.
Dirty Dozen and Rosemary's Baby, but like other things.
No,
but,
he's done.
He was also in De Palma. He was in The Fury. It's
right,
like he
Fury,
did some
yeah.
movies that were like, you know, I'm not saying The Fury is bad, but it's not, Cassavetes is obviously, you know, he's trying to like get Minnie and Moskowitz out there, so he's like taking a paycheck, you know.
Right.
It happens, man. We were reading the other day about how. George Clooney wants to do small movies. He's always wanted to do small movies. And he goes and makes his money overseas doing coffee commercials.
Nothing wrong with that, dude. Yeah.
That's what he does. He goes, I want to live in a nice house, so I go overseas to do a coffee commercial. I did Ides of March for $12 million with that cast.
Guys,
with that movie, $12 million.
Yeah, that's what you do. It's like, listen, you guys ever seen the Coors commercial, The Love Train?
Yeah.
Me and another guy designed that train.
Wow.
I don't get any credit for that train, but I did those. I did the first round of those commercials. So
that's wild.
So, you know, there's stuff I've done that's like all the, you know, I did a bunch of Cadillac spots.
That,
it's like
that train rolled me over on a couple occasions.
Oh,
had trouble getting out of bed.
You and me both. But I think you can't, again, I think when you get hung up on this thing, I can only do this, you're bullshitting yourself, man. You know, listen, John Huston, for every, like, you know, Moby Dick and Red Badge of Courage, he did Fat City.
Absolutely.
And, you know, it's like
Under the Volcano,
the Dead.
Wise Blood.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. He had those movies.
I think that's great. Well, I want to wrap up talking about The Gray real quick once again. The Gray is in theaters Friday. My review of it is this is going to be a film I hope does really well, so they re-release it in the fall, and it could get nominated for the Oscar it deserves. I think it's an Oscar picture. And I think Liam Neeson's up there, and I think the writing's great. And I'm going to tell you something. This film isn't overwritten, which is what I love. It's not too wordy. All the words were perfect.
Yeah.
It just all was perfect. Whether it was three words or whether it was a short speech, it all worked.
That's great, bro.
You did a great job
still entertaining, too.
Editing yourself. There is not a minute you won't be on the edge of your seat for this movie because you got the fear factor going along with the philosophical factor.
You don't overcut so you know what's happening either. It's like you guys, there's this thing where like they're walking through the snow and the guy's like, you're panning down from a point of view shot at a guy's legs trying to get up in the snow because it's hard, and then pan over and there's the wolves coming out. I won't, but like, that's great. That's thrilling stuff. It was like actually. Very entertaining at
That's
the same time.
That's great, man. I'm glad you guys feel that way.
And
it's great.
Joe, I wanted to thank you. I mean, I know you're busy with this publicity tour and everything and blah, blah, blah. And you came and you did like 45, 50 minutes with us.
Oh, man, it's a pleasure.
It
come on, I just killed a couple of beers, bro. I'm in a Detroit.
World,
it's great. No, come on. It's my pleasure.
When I
Thanks
saw
for
you
having
get
me.
A beer, I got a beer. Joe's going to drink.
Lee got a beer, but he hasn't touched it. On the other hand, just drank the six-pack.
We get great guests on the show, and I found myself all week, and Lee's probably seen me doing it. I'll be on the show with my booker, I'm on the phone with my booker or with my producer, Cesar Marconi, and I'll be like, I can't believe Joe wants to do the show, and he wants to do it for an hour. He's out of his fucking mind.
No, bro. I had a blast. It was a lot of fun coming
in here.
It's just a very, you know what I love? I love talking to guys who are completely... who I recognize is from my own tribe, right?
Yeah.
Writers.
Yeah.
We're your audience.
Yeah,
absolutely. The Midwest, too.
And by the way, guys, that's what I'm saying. For you to respond the way you have to this film is probably the most gratifying for me because you literally are from my neck of the woods.
Awesome.
So
it's awesome. I'm telling you, people are going to love this. And the best part is it's any demographic. I wanted to tell you, I forgot, or I don't remember. But we left the theater, and you were asking about mainstream audiences. We saw... some of it with the mainstream audience, and we were stuck in an elevator, and it was packed, and everyone was talking about it. Everyone
That's
loved
great,
it.
That's great, man.
That's great. Just like, you know, there were these average Mexican broads who aren't writing reviews anywhere. So they were loving it, and this old guy came in, he was like 80, and he was talking about, oh, man, I hope we don't get stuck in this elevator, and there's wolves.
You're right.
Oh, that's great. See, that's what I want, man.
They're stuck in the elevator.
Yeah, you got these people going, You got these people going.
Oh, you sounded like a Pacino there.
Yeah, it was a little, yeah.
Hey, Mel, you fucked up,
Mexican
Mel.
Pacino.
Yeah, right. It's not where I want to be. It's not where I want to be right now.
So thank you so much for doing this, Joe. The Gray
Pleasure,
is in
brother.
Theaters this Friday. I hope you come on anytime you have a movie.
Dude, are you kidding me? I'll roll down Sunset, and my buddy owns Rock and Riley's up the street, so I'm here.
Love,
man.
Rock and Riley's.
That's
man.
Where
New
we,
Year's Eve there.
I threw up there on New Year's.
Brother, by the way, Craig Lay, good Michigan kid. Open that bar. Go support it. It's
Mike,
fantastic.
Mike and I will wander over there and have cigars in the back. Have you been
it
in
is.
The back?
Oh, bro,
with
it's
the
brilliant.
Yeah.
It's
smoke
brilliant,
there.
Man.
I can sit out on the couch.
I've had some, and they have some of the greatest Irish whiskey. I've had some legless evenings there, I can tell you that.
That's good.
So Rock and Riley's also, which is just awesome. You got to go there. It's a couple, it's next to Whiskey A Go-Go. It's awesome. We spent New Year's there. Everyone that's been on my Facebook and Twitter, you've seen the pictures. It was a blast.
Yeah,
it's a great spot,
fucking
man.
Blast there.
Great spot.
So thank you so much, Joe. The Gray in theaters this Friday. Liam Neeson, Joe Carnahan, writer, director. Thank you very much. We're going to call Ronnie at Cigars and Stripes in about 20 minutes.
Our buddy Ronnie Lotz.
Yeah, he's the best. here's the thing. I want to talk about the State of the Union. This is going to be really funny. Both of you guys listened to it or watched it.
Yeah.
Julia was radioing it up.
I was radioing it up.
You know, I thought Rod Lurie was the only one that listens to politics on the radio.
He listened
to debate, the GOP debate on the radio.
Yeah.
And I'm like, Rod, you got like 28 TVs.
I hope he was on a rocking chair on a porch sipping mint julep while he was doing it, fanning himself wearing a straw hat. That's great.
So explain to me what you took out of that State of the Union address, and then we'll get to the GOP response, which, by the way, I love that they act like they're all working together and there's no bad guys or good guys. But then they give a response from the stereotypical bad guy
or
good guy, whatever way you want to look at. But they give you a response from the other team.
Those responses are always lousy. Like, they're never very – they don't work. They don't have the gravitas because they only have 12 minutes. And when Bush was president, the Democratic responses were lousy, too.
No, yeah, they were terrible.
Right.
It's always just – it's such an afterthought.
But
and by the way,
just shoot down the State of the Union address? Like, isn't that supposed to sit with you, and then you're supposed to think about it? And then why is there a different response given?
I just think it shames the opposition party because it always looks so paltry by comparison because it's one guy in a room and he gets 12 minutes. He doesn't have people applauding.
Could
they get someone other than Mitch Daniels?
Do you prefer Bobby Jindal like you had a few years ago?
Right.
I mean...
Oh, okay.
Good old Bobby
Jindal. That was brutal.
Or you know, for me, I think it's just simple for people at home. I think if they want to root for their team,
right,
and now their team gets to talk and give their side. Mm-hmm. And I don't know. I just think that does a disservice to the whole State of the Union.
I think they should have Al Sharpton do it.
They got the pot all over their face.
I don't know if we said this on the show, but if you can pull up on YouTube, it's a spot for MSNBC at Al Sharpton, who I don't know if he still has his own show, but he's making this hilarious, like, barnyard folk America analogy to the GOP's mishandling of funds.
All right, you got to listen.
All right, we'll play it now.
I grew up here in Brooklyn, and we used to come home from school. My mother, some of the ladies in the neighborhood would make blueberry pie, and we would rush in knowing our mothers were still working, and we'd eat. They'd come in, did y'all eat the pie? No, and blueberry would be all over our face. They were the ones eating the pie.
They were the ones.
All I hear is, I love it.
I love that commercial.
I love that.
It's great.
Yeah.
The GOP, they got the pie all over their face.
They're the ones that be eating up all the pie.
I think they should
do more like that. They should have him say, you know, other issues. You know,
I think that commercial gets people to watch MSNBC.
Right.
Yeah. And Al, because Al's a great.
But I don't think, does Al have a show now?
He does have a show.
Is it on the weekend?
Yeah. It's on.
Because they got enough
everybody.
Ed Schultz going on.
I think it's on before Chris Matthews.
Our inability to regulate the financial market.
Oh, so it's on
market.
Like early afternoon.
Yeah.
When my mama was disciplining me, we used to have to cut a switch from the tree. And that's what the GOP is doing.
Yeah.
They don't cut the switch to spank Wall Street.
Now, Julia, are you with me? I don't know if we've talked about this. Are you with me on the Ed Schultz? Get him off that network.
Ed's...
we haven't talked about him.
He's ridiculous.
I mean, he's a little...
He's ridiculous. With
the
twittering at the bottom of the page. And
of course,
he's always loud and in people's faces.
Whenever I tried to Twitter the Ed Schultz show, I use a lot of salty language.
It never
shows up. So,
Lee, what happened? Yeah. We're watching Ed
Schultz. We were trying to tweet the show... And they didn't put our tweets on.
No.
Although I always suspect when these pundit shows put tweets on that their own people are writing the tweets.
I think so too.
Well, I said, Ed, I wrote something to the effect of, at Ed Schultz show, why don't you give a more fair and balanced opinion? Is it like a joke, you know? Just to see if they'd air it? No. They have no interest in that.
Well,
no.
you know that there's something that rings phony about them because they're not extreme. People tweet extreme.
That's
true. They're like bland stuff, like, you know,
there's
no way someone wrote that.
No.
3 exclamation marks. Like the person was yelling while they were tweeting it.
All right, so the State of the Union, I mean, we didn't get to really the meat of it, but, I mean, so for me what worked about it is if if Obama is going to actually go through with everything, or if Congress lets him go through with even some of it, I think we're in good shape. I mean, I love the infrastructure
yeah.
idea. I love the idea about taxing companies that outsource jobs.
Yep.
Instead of giving them tax breaks.
Give them incentive to keep jobs.
I love the tax breaks for small businesses. I love the stuff he's doing with jobs. And I love he had a plan.
Yeah.
He actually had plans.
Funny, this was kind of like the GOP's plan yeah. about a year. They've been kind of touting this idea, but as soon as Obama says it, it's horrible, evil, awful crap.
Yeah, Brett Cullen told me if a Republican gave that speech yesterday, he'd be the Messiah.
And also, this is probably going to piss off a lot of people, but honestly, if Obama was a white man, there wouldn't be nearly as much shit thrown at him by the GOP.
I wish at this point in time I could disagree with you, and I think you're right.
I think that he's got some real balls because
he does.
In that speech, he pretty much gave Congress a spanking with words.
Yeah.
And I've always been someone who thinks that the State of the Union address is just not really a big part of the president's agenda because he just gets up and says stuff,
mm-hmm.
and it's not really – it's not something – I don't think it's something that should be given tons of weight. But what he did was basically like, get the bill on my debt.
It's basically a wish list.
He said five times.
Yeah.
He's like, get the bill on my debt.
Yeah.
And the thing that was crazy was he was like, all right, we're going to change the system so shit gets done and people don't hate Congress
yeah.
anymore.
Yeah.
That is something I'm a little more skeptical about because...
Oh, of course. You're right to be skeptical.
Business yeah. and government have been in bed together our whole lives.
Well, I got a clip for
point.
That. It's
and
funny you bring that
changing
up.
Changing the system is another matter entirely, and I don't know any president that says is going to do that...
Well,
is going to actually get me to vote.
Speaking of all that, here is Jon Stewart on The Daily Show last night talking about Mitt Romney. It's a 6-minute clip. The only reason I'm going to play all of it is I think it's all great.
Yeah.
And I think it's very funny, and I think it's also... look, if comedy can spell things out easier for people about some of these candidates... I'll take it.
Absolutely.
I'll take it. Like South Park did with Scientology and many other things. I'll take it. If that's what it takes. So here we go.
Welcome to the Daily Show. My name is Jon Stewart. Fine show tonight. My guest tonight from the great state of Massachusetts, Senate candidate Elizabeth Warren is going to be on the show tonight, and she and I will arm wrestle.
If I beat her, I get to join a league.
As you know, tonight is the president's State of the Union address, and we will have more coverage of America's yearly empty gesture tomorrow. But for tonight, exciting news. Mitt Romney's 550-page 2010 tax return has been made public. It's an exciting topic that in no way needs zazzing up. So let's get right to it in tonight's segment. As you know, when it comes to if and when Mitt Romney would release his tax returns, he has, along with everything else in this campaign, been nothing if not consistent.
But you won't do tax
returns. I don't intend to release tax returns.
Mitt?
Time will tell. That's not something I'm planning today, but never say never.
Mitt Romney?
What's happened in history is people have released them in about April of the coming year, and that's probably what I do.
Bartholomew Willard Romney Bonham Carter loves you at the third. Your tax return, sir!
I'll do that on Tuesday of this week.
Thank you. Just that easy.
I'm never going to do it. I'll do it in April. Until last night, Romney released the Quicken.
The Republican candidate paid about $6 million in taxes over the past 2 years.
$6 million over 2 years? Taxes? That's like one bionic man. That's like, woo!
He made a combined income in those 2 years of nearly $43 million.
Oh, wait, so $6 million then is only 803.
carry those.
His overall effective rate comes in at about 13.9%.
Yes, no, that's what I got. At first, I hadn't carried the math. Wait a minute, 13.9%? That's a tax rate like for someone who makes about $50,000 a year, not someone who makes...
That combined income comes out to $56,986 a day.
$56,986 a day. That's almost $57,000 a day. And here's the most amazing part. The guy doesn't even have a job. That is interest. That's the kind of money that might lead a man to make stupidly extravagant, out-of-touch impulse bets.
$10,000. $10,000 bet.
See, to him, it was... That's why when he throws that out, they're like, $10,000. I'll bet you whatever I make in the time it takes me to finish this sentence. $10,000. Oh, 12, 15. Take the bet before I keep talking. How in the world do you, Mitt Romney, justify making more in one day than the median American family makes in a year while paying an effective tax rate of the guy who has to scan your shoes at the airport?
I pay all the taxes that are legally required and not a dollar more. I don't think you want someone as the candidate for president who pays more taxes than he owes.
No, but you might want one who thinks that's wrong. Because here's the little game Romney gets to play. This is the game that Mitt Romney gets to play. Yes, his tax burden is absurdly low, but he's just following the provisions in the tax code. There's nothing he can do about it. He's just a law-abiding citizen. But here's what you don't know about the rules of that little game. In 2007, there was a bipartisan bill to make private equity investors like Romney pay the ordinary income tax rate of 35% on their carried interest earnings, instead of the 15% they've been paying since 1987. Well, funny story.
Do you suspect that the tax treatment for carried interest will be changed?
Listen, if I could tell you about the number of lobbyists that have been hired in the last 2 months to work this issue, you would know that it'd be very risky for me to predict what would happen on this.
Oh, may I make a prediction? Because I'm in the future. Yeah, they killed it. Now, by the way, who were those lobbyists who had so much influence over our government that Charlie Grassley, the Republican Senate Finance Committee's ranking guy, he co-sponsored the bill to adjust the tax rate? Who are the lobbyists that are so powerful? This guy f***s his bricks like he's talking about Voldemort when he brings them up. Well, it was the Private Equity Council, a lobbying group formed, surprise, surprise, that very year by the country's biggest private equity firms, including Mitt Romney's Bain Capital. Now, to be fair, Bain is not Romney. Romney is not necessarily Bain. This whole issue could be an issue they part ways on. And roll tape from 2007.
Have you come out on the proposals coming out of the Democratic Congress to raise taxes on hedge funds, private equity funds, venture capital funds, and so forth?
Yeah, I don't think it's a good idea to raise taxes.
Yeah, because they're your taxes! Not to say Mitt Romney doesn't believe... Not to say Mitt Romney doesn't believe the tax system need not be reformed. There are certain taxes he feels should be raised.
47% of Americans paying no income tax. That's a heck of a big number.
Yes. The tax code is so unfair to you. So to clarify, the millions of dollars that Mitt Romney saves because of the aggressively lobbied 15% tax rate is legal and fair. And he's entitled to that from the government, no strings attached. But where does Romney stand on other such government largesse?
I also like the idea that people who are receiving assistance, welfare assistance, have a responsibility of working. I think he wants us to become an entitlement society where the people in this country feel they're all entitled to something but from government.
Poor people have lobbyists.
Oh...
I have an observation here. I just as soon as he said quicken, all I could see was Romney sitting in front of a little computer with pencils sticking out of his hair and out of his ears, going, shit, how am I going to make this sound less than $57,000 a day?
Well, did you see the... by the way, there's two reasons I played the clip and played it that long. Is one, I think, this is stuff maybe I know or Lee knows or people that follow. But we're an entertainment show for the most part. Most of our people may not follow that. And I think that was important. Also, I love playing shows that are better than ours as long as possible show. That is what I like doing. Yeah. It makes us look better. That's the best 6 minutes our show will do today.
That was our that was our research. Yeah.
Right.
No, but Mitt's ridiculous.
Well, did you see there was the GOP debate where Gingrich said to Romney, so you're going to release your tax return? And he goes, I might, And everyone started booing.
Yeah. I'm just kind of with Julia. I love the Quicken idea.
I love the Quicken idea.
That's funny.
I got a deal on the Quicken. I got a coupon.
I got a Groupon.
Groupon.
What are my taxes?
What'd you say about how much money a day Mitt Romney makes?
$57,000
about.
$57,000
A day.
Okay.
And he doesn't do jack shit.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
If I made $57,000 a day, I wouldn't know. I mean, if the taxes, like, I'd be like, I'd like 2,700 big Snickers bars for $2 a piece. And that's one day.
But see, the best part about all this is the clips that he's playing where he's like, but we need to tax more for the poor people.
Right.
Oh, and I love this idea, and it's Republican, and it's also somewhat Democrat, because there isn't really much of a difference anymore. There's extreme Republicans and extreme Democrats and a ton of moderates. And there's this idea now that people are tossing around this word entitlement.
That's such crap.
They
don't think they understand the definition of entitlement. It's just like socialism.
Yeah.
I love how people call Obama a Marxist, socialist, Kenyan Muslim. I want to know how that works.
None of those people have been to a socialist country or have any idea how one works, by the way.
No. So do we call Ronnie?
Let's call Ronnie.
Do we get the comedy portion of the show going?
Yeah, right.
Okay, here I
still with us, America?
Here we go. No, they're like, when's Joe Carnahan coming on?
Yeah.
Jesus, I can't listen to these guys.
Get that goofy broad off.
Oh, no, they think you're Steve Guttenberg, so they're
good.
Oh, my God.
They're like, she sounds just like Steve.
What?
No, just kidding. Holy what?
Jeez Louise, I was hoping more like Rulalenska or Brenda Vaccaro. Man, I'm going to go...
You have a Donna Reed thing.
Oh, boy.
All right, Ronnie Lotz of Cigars and Stripes.
In Berwyn,
Illinois.
Berwyn,
Ogden, Chicago's best kept secret.
Yeah.
I'm not kidding.
Hello.
Ronnie.
Yes, sir.
You're on the Matthew Aaron Show. Are you living the dream, pal?
What do you mean I'm on the map? What do you mean I'm on the show? You guys are doing shows at nighttime. What are you doing now? What do you mean? Are you pre-recording?
No, we do them during the days, too.
Well, Ronnie, we have to because Matt has a meeting to go after.
I have a meeting.
It's very important.
Oh, my God. Lee Caprios. What's going on out there, man?
How are you, Ron?
You know what? Today's going to be a good fucking day. You know what? I've made up my mind. You know? I'm going to... Listen, man. I'm going to take a shower today. You know what I mean? I mean, I'm going to do it. Listen, sometimes you just got to go for it, you know? I got to spruce up. I'm doing this shit, man.
Yeah.
Soap and everything.
Oh, I love it.
Congratulations on the soap products, Ronnie.
Whatever.
You're also on the phone with our special co-host today, Julia Gray. Say hello, Julia.
Hi, Ronnie.
Hello, Julia. How are you?
Fine, thanks. How are you? Ronnie Lott. Now, weren't you a player in the NFL?
Oh, yes. I'm a giant black man.
You are.
Perfect.
Awesome.
Yes, I'm. Yes. No, listen to me. Listen. I'm nervous. You know what I mean? I'm like, I can't explain this to you, man. I'm like, listen, if Richard, what's his fucking name? Regis Philbin. If he was like a steroided up midget, you know what I mean? And then Richard Lewis ate him and Mike Tyson punched him in the face. That's how nerved up I am. That's what I am right now. I can't tell you. I'm beside myself.
So Richard Lewis ate Regis Philbin. That is.
I'm just saying, man. That's how nerd. But he had to eat. If Regis Philbin was a steroided up midget, you know what I mean? I'm just like I'm just so. Customer said to me right now, why do you play smooth jazz music? Why do you play smooth jazz music? So you assholes put quarters in the jukebox.
Oh, yeah.
Hey, I like my Bruce Hornsby.
For those of a little backstory on Ronnie for our listeners, Ronnie introduced me to Matt, or Matt to me. We love Ronnie on the show. That's why I keep calling him. He's a little bit like if you rolled Vince McMahon, Charles Bukowski, and Ben Gazzara's character in Killing of a Chinese Bookie all into one.
Well, gee, thank you. Thank you. That's great. Listen, you guys had to get together. You had to come together. It's not often there's two people that walk into this building with an ounce of talent. You know what I mean? It's like, go look at this guy. You got to meet this guy. Do something. Somebody fucking do something out here. Jesus Christ.
You got Jack Mantooth back there, Ronnie.
Jack Mantooth pulled his penis out the other day.
I'm sorry, Jack Mantooth? Any relation to Randy Mantooth?
No.
Oh, shit.
Also, if you're listening, if you're going to pull your penis out at an open mic, Cigars and Stripes is the one to do it.
Yeah, Jesus Christ.
I can laugh.
Oh, you know, listen to me. I don't know. Listen, you know what's even funnier? Is that kid, you know, he looks exactly like Tom Cruise. It's kind of creepy. Like, my 13-year-old came home with some kid. I was like, hey, you know who this is? They're like, who? I'm like, it's fucking Tom Cruise. They're like, they look like their jaws dropped. Like, no shit. I'm like, he really looks like him. He really does. I would use that to get laid all the time. I'm a stand-in for Tom Cruise. You know what I mean?
Except the problem is he starts to talk.
Yes.
You don't talk like Tom Cruise.
Tom Cruise was, like, doing fine.
Well, you know, Little Jack Mantooth history, you know, he was the first person in the town of Cicero to get his car impounded on the drug and illegal search and seizure program. So that's his claim to fame. You know what I mean?
Little American
Cicero,
history.
That's pretty good.
Yeah, little. Yeah, in Cicero.
Cicero.
Well, they probably just passed that law like 6 months ago, and they fought against it. Trust me.
Oh, probably Betty Lauren Maltese has been fighting it for years.
Oh, Black
now.
Betty.
I love her.
I was at an AA meeting the other day. And there was a guy from Cicero that gave the speech there. And afterwards, him and I were, like, hanging out and talking because we're a couple Chicago guys.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we have had the longest conversation in Los Angeles history about Black Betty. So
she's my style icon. I just love her. I hope to look like her in about 5 years. I'm going to poop it up and you know it.
Yeah, Ron.
She used to strip at Front 75 down the block here when we were kids. A place, a strip club called Front 75. We used to peek in the windows on our bicycles all the time.
Oh,
wait,
God.
Are you being real, Betty Maltese?
No, I'm not kidding with you. Listen, they say she was a stripper there. I wouldn't know one pick from the other when I was a kid, but I'll tell you this. I think she was definitely the one running the bar or the door or whatever.
Matt, I'm going to be in the corner crying.
Listen, this guy works for the CTA. He comes in here every single day, every single day. He says, well, I come home, and my wife says to me, why? That's the Chicago Transit Authority, by the way. Why do you come home and have a beer every day? Why do you have a glass of wine? He says, so I don't kill somebody. You know what I mean?
I think it's required that if you work for the CTA, you drink a
right.
lot. There's especially if you drink on the job.
Usually on the job, yeah.
There's a guy that does comedy in Chicago. He used to drive a bus. I don't know if he still does. And he goes by Mike the Psycho Bus Driver. That's what he signs up on the list as. And he's funny, and he's a real character. I don't know if he ever comes to Cigars, but man, has this guy got some dark thoughts driving a bus.
Lee, Ronnie, why don't you have Mike the Psycho ever over to Cigars?
Yeah.
I don't know. Listen, give me his phone number. I'll call him right now. I don't care. I'll call him. Get him in here.
Honey, do you believe in
recovery.
Sex addiction, Ronnie?
What kind of addiction?
Sex addiction.
Sex addiction? I don't know. Listen to me, man. It's all I know is I bought a BlackBerry playbook, and now all of a sudden I got to go get reading glasses. Do I really care about ass that much? You know, what I'm saying?
Ass a lot here.
I'm married.
What's
yeah, where am I going?
Where am I going?
I go to fucking Mexico. I tell my wife, listen, I'm in Mexico. My wife, I said, listen, honey, why don't you get on the bus and go pick up a 12-pack? I'll see you in the hotel. You know what I'm saying? Go on the bus at 9 o'clock and just see what happens. You know, and come back with some beer. Fuck it, I'm married. Fuck it.
Ronnie, be honest with me. As a married guy, how much do you get laid and how much do you got jerk off? What's the ratio?
Listen to me. God, you stumped me. It's like I'm sick and tired of hearing this. I hate these type A personality guys. Like, I gotta have my pussy. My old lady doesn't give me my pussy. And I'm talking about short, fat, dumb-looking guys with big heads talking about how much pussy they get from their wives. It's like, shut up. You're not getting laid. I know, you're a porno star. Yeah, you're right. Your wife's giving you ass six times a week. Go fuck yourself. You're full of shit. I mean, how much time you had at 44? You know, I mean, like, really? I think about it.
Cool.
Yes.
That was a very creative way of Ronnie not answering the question.
Well, I don't want to answer the question. Ask the woman sitting next to you. How often do you want to give it to your man? I mean, realistically. Listen, if my wife needs hey, she wanted to put fucking suntan lotion on my back. You know what I'm saying? It's like, right. Yeah. And I was getting my hair cut today, and the lady says, she won't put suntan lotion on your back. I'm just saying, because she brought up the same goddamn question from 40-year-old beautician. And I'm like, look. I don't even go there with you. You're like 65 years old and you're a Mexican lady. You know, it's just like, why are we doing this?
Oh, dear God.
I think that answered my question in a weird way.
Well, listen, the Mexican lady, she says, well, your wife will give it to you when she wants something. I mean, yeah, the only thing she's going to give you is she wants me to take out the garbage or something, whatever.
Oh. You purposely not do shit around the house, Ronnie, so you get some?
I don't do anything anymore, man. I had my own separate bathroom, you know what I mean? And I got a 13-year-old, and I took in this 27-year-old son of mine, you know what I mean? You know, my wife had him when she was like 11, so he's a stepson, you know, whatever. And now he's living there. I'm like, you know what? I am not doing shit in this bathroom. I'm not doing anything in here. You guys are on your own. You wouldn't believe what it looks like in there. I got to call, whatever. I got to get a maid service. I'm throwing someone out of this house soon. It's soon.
What's that great Woody Allen line? Last time I was inside a woman was when I was inside. I'm laughing. I'm sorry. Last time I was in the Statue of Liberty or something.
Oh, yeah, right.
I totally butchered it and I apologize.
So, Ryan, what's going on at cigars? Any crazy stories other than Jack Mantooth whipping out his small dick?
No, I don't know. I mean, there's some comics are really. I'm going to tell you something. Last weekend, and this is the truth. I don't know what happened, but we had like an open mic, and it was just, I'm going to tell you, a lot of nice, heavy hitters in Chicago, whatever they may be and whoever they may be, I have to tell you, came out of the woodwork last week, and they just kind of dialed this open mic in, and every comic was better than the other one, and the place was packed. I mean, elbow to elbow, and the comics, for some reason, I don't know what happened, but they all lit on fire, and it was really a good show, man, and in fact, I sent out a text message or a tweet. I don't even know what I do on that thing, but it said, listen, nights like tonight really make me love having Cigars and Stripes and supporting local arts. You know what I mean? Because it was just, that's all I said. I wasn't even like, hey, come up for a 50-cent beer, whatever I do. You know, it was just, it was a magical night.
So Ronnie, who was all there? Who's the heavy hitters that showed up? Who did you have that was really great this week?
Well, I don't know. Like, this Dan Brennan really has come around. Just like, I can't explain it, man, but his he's just evolved. And even though, you know, you get so used to them doing the same repetitive, long, nonsensical bits. However, occasionally they wake up with a fresh thought and they bring it to the stage, which is nice. And then all of a sudden, wow, you get a fresh look at an old comic. And then if the audience is half people he's never seen before, he'll pull out like a staple or something. And then you know what? Before you know it, you got a really good set. Eric Pinnell came out of nowhere, that cocksucker. I threw him out of here one time. Anyway, he's back. But whatever, you know, he's really good. And he came out and totally did his old bit. You know, I'm waving with my finger or whatever his whole bit is. And then, but no one saw him before. He rocked the place. It was just, everything was really good.
Yeah, Pinnell's a good guy.
That's great. So so the crowds are doing good even for the winter and stuff? Because I remember I remember last year it was brutal. I'd be outside smoking the whole time in like 10-degree weather. It was brutal.
Yeah, I know. I don't know. Listen, you always kept to yourself anyway. Even if we had a packed house, you were always like the mayor of the fucking beer garden. You know, you always sat back there and people come like the godfather. You know, you come back there, oh, you're doing that, too. They all go back in. You're like, who's on? I always go see this weird guy. You'd never move. You know, whatever.
Can I tell you something? Oh. I miss those days and those problems, Ronnie. I don't like being an adult out here.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I don't, and I'm probably repeating myself, but I don't like pulling up to a stoplight, you know, in L.A. and then just saying, well, I'm surrounded by $250,000 worth of cars, you know. I can't, it's uncomfortable, because I just realized I have to be a waiter, but I couldn't even get a waiter job because they're all taken out there, you know what I mean? I couldn't do it, I couldn't survive it.
Hey, Ryan, did you happen to catch the State of the Union address yesterday? I'm dying.
How could I do that? How could I possibly do that? I was at some asshole dinner with my brother-in-law. you know, for his birthday. Great. Oh, I probably got just as much information from that bastard as I would on the TV anyway. Yeah. You know what I mean? Opinionated prick.
Oh, there's a lot of love there. I can just feel it.
Ronnie, what's going on? I heard on, like, Saturdays or something, you're doing, like, a Mystery Science Theater, like, movie night.
Oh, you know what? That's actually going pretty well. That creepy Horatio guy and that big Irish guy, Patrick Bagden. See, that's what we're working on. He actually called me today. They do, like, a Mystery Science 3000, whatever they call it, movie thing.
Yeah.
And what happens is... They get old bad movie and they all talk about it and it works out pretty well. But I want them to hold lights up on their faces, so I'm going to put it on the stage. I mean, there's something missing to it, something, you know. Listen, this is nothing innovative, but I'll tell you what, it sure was a fresh look at really bad movies, which we do here constantly anyway. So,
yeah. So what movies did you play, Ronnie? And Horatio and Pat Killed It.
Oh man, Hobo with a Shotgun.
Did you like that one with Rutger Hauer? Did you like it?
Listen. Yeah. I have a brain. I am a very simple person. I'm a child. Yes, of course, I adored that movie. It was hilarious.
Yeah,
you know, it was weird because we had the sound down just enough. People were actually watching this movie, and they were chiming in at the right times. There was this other kid with them. I don't know. It's actually pretty good. We're doing it again at the end of this month.
What
you know,
movie gonna be playing. Do you know?
I don't know. That's what I think we're gonna do, like, you know, Troll 2 or something stupid. I have no idea.
There you go.
That's great. That's perfect.
Listen, young lady, let me ask you a question. Do you feel a little odd sitting there with those two gentlemen there? What's going on? I mean, how long have you been with them?
Are you kidding me? I worked in Hollywood for 11 years in editing, and I worked with some of the most, you know,
she's
out there.
She's got pepper spray.
Absolutely. I'm totally used to it. I worked with people who used to swear and talk and do coke and show their penises. And
oh, well, shit, you should move to Berlin.
You're genteel compared to them.
You know, you're totally genteel.
You worked at Cigars and Stripes, is what you're saying, Julie.
Yeah, right.
No. And also, I'm a journalist, so, you know, I'm used to this kind of crap. It doesn't bother me at all. Trust me. I feel very much at home, very comfortable, within my element.
Julia sometimes curses more than I do.
Oh, right. If that's possible.
Do you still open the show, but with doing some of your ranting?
Listen, I'm trying to stay away from it. I try not to even be, not really. I don't know. All I know is I'm busting out the paint gun this week because I've had it. I'm not kidding with you. I'm going to Sports Authority out here, and I'm getting the paintball bullets. And if I hear one comic, I'm warning them when they come in. If you repeat a goddamn bit you did in the last year here, I'm shooting you right in the fucking chest.
Oh,
I'm going to give them T-shirts. I'm repeating myself. I'm doing it this week.
Right.
I'm going to give them bullseye T-shirts, and I'm going to shoot them right in the chest. And they're also going to get safety goggles so I don't get sued. In fact, I don't give a shit if I get sued. Get me out of this misery.
I need to know if this story's true, Ronnie. I heard you had a bunch of comics one time going way over the time. It wasn't going well. And someone told me that you put a gun on the bar.
Listen, it's all I'm saying is that people seem to pay attention when you pull out a fucking loaded pistol. They all seem to listen then. It's like, Jack Mantooth actually had to... Hey, you know, everyone wants to, you know, motherfuck him. You know what I mean? Oh, he's an asshole. But he actually went out of line. Listen, the show was going so downhill. It was... People just started... You know, listen... You got to bring it to the stage here. You got to have something to say when you're here. You can't just go up there and they'll eat you alive here. Anyway, the show was going. The people started doing their little gab, and they wanted to go outside and smoke. And the one guy was the son of a bitch who didn't pay, kept barking and barking. And finally, Jack Mantooth just says, "Hey, motherfucker! You know what I mean? Shut your mouth! Shut your." And he walked in the bar, and he's like, "I'll choke you with my dick," he tells him. And listen, after that, guess what happened? Little silence, and then the next comic brought it to the table, and then the next one, and the next one. Before you know it, he gained control of that room. And if he didn't do that, the night was shot. Because Lord knows the host wasn't going to do it. John Griffin, hey man, you know, like Sammy Davis Jr., great, good for you. You know, that's great, but that's not gonna make him shut up, man. You're going to have something to say. You know what I'm saying?
What I love is one time John Griffin wore blackface on stage. And blacked up his hands, everything, and pretended to be
Sammy Davis
Jr. It was so, like, offensive, except it's John Griffin.
Right.
See, I have my differences on this, because he pulled that shit I said, for Halloween, you're doing the blackface. It's not blackface. He kept saying, why blackface? I said, no, it's a Sammy Davis Jr. impersonator. Sammy Davis Jr. was a great American icon. Shut your mouth. You've been talking about Sammy Davis Jr. impersonations forever. Put on the makeup, and I want you with the purple suit, I want the shoes on, the afro, I want the glasses, the glass, I want the whole nine yards. Yeah, he did it. And then the next night, I paid the son of a bitch to do it again, and he comes out, and he's got no makeup on but the suit on.
Yeah.
So you look like an asshole. Then he wants to get paid. I gave him half the money. I said, I got half the bid, you're getting half the money. You're an asshole. Why don't you warn me of this? Why? I'm not doing blackface. I'm like, it's not blackface. God damn it, man. What is this? Every time you bring up the word black or Sammy Davis Jr., all of a sudden you're a racist? What the fuck? Look at Eddie Murphy.
Wait, Eddie Murphy is...
Well, Eddie Murphy makes fun of white people all the time, man. That's his thing. You know, whatever. Who cares?
Oh,
it's an art.
God. It's art. Yeah, right. It's art. Oh.
It is art. You know what I mean? It is art. And people got to understand, when you get on that stage, that's a public theater arena. Listen, and, you know, some of these black comics come in, they say, these are just jokes. These are just jokes. And they'll lay in the white people. Listen, a lot of people, they go to that kind of thing. You know what I mean? That's where they go on stage. I think when you're on stage at Cigar and Stripes or any comedy club, I think that should be, hey, listen, we're all you know, good-minded people here. We're out to see live entertainment. Let it be. Enjoy it. Look at it for an art form. Be opinionated, but keep it to yourself. If you don't like it, don't come.
You know what's funny is if Michael Richards did his act that he did at Cigars and Stripes, only in Berwyn,
yeah, right,
on Wednesday nights and open mic.
Berwyn or Sicily.
It's not that his act would have gone over, but it wouldn't have offended anybody because we've heard worse.
Right.
Okay, people forget about his appearances on Fridays Hall. They have a real serious sideshow guy on putting swords down his stomach, and then, you know, they come out and they run and push him. You know what I mean? They forget about Andy Kaufman's bit where he would run around the Memphis and actually get on public television and make fun of hillbillies and say, I want to wrestle your fat wives. Everything was a gimmick. You know what I mean? So don't be surprised if Michael Richards had that thing kind of hot set up. And I know it didn't help the sales at all of the Seinfeld release of their, you know, their VHS, you know, tapes they were set, you know, they're finally putting out. But I'll know this. You couldn't get a seat in that place, you know, 3 months after Michael Richards did that. And I tell you, sometimes I think it was set up, and I really don't believe for one minute, I think it was an artistic statement. I think that was pushing things to the limit, much like Andy Kaufman. He's from that old school of comedy. I wouldn't be surprised if that was purpose.
I want to read something to you, Ryan, get your opinion, since we brought Michael Richards. Dane Cook was at the Laugh Factory this last weekend, and there was a whole list of comedians prepared to perform, and Dane Cook walked in and basically took over. He didn't let the other comedians perform, which happens all the time when you have a headliner that walks in. I mean, if Eddie Murphy walked into Cigars and Stripes and John Griffin was prepared to go on, you tell John you're off tonight. See you later, pal. So, look, I mean, that happens. But here are some things that Dane Cook said.
Who he stole from?
No, he actually didn't steal. He walked... Well, someone said, for instance, we watched him spiral for 45 minutes before I left. Could have been worse. He could have done his act. YouTube star Jenna Marbles, who was doing the show that night, was slightly less charitable, saying, Dane Cook took a shit on everyone. Might as well have been literally. Yeah. So Dane came in there. He was basically talking about how everyone, you know, he was talking about, he was being very misogynistic, cruel, vicious, and arrogant. He was talking about how everyone should like him. He's the king of MySpace. He had hit movies. Women should be bending over backwards to be with him. And then he was just being, like, really, really awful. What do you think of things like that, Ronnie? What do you think of this story?
Well, I'm trying to think. The last words, is that what his whole bit was? I mean, what are they complaining about? I mean, what is the main beef? I mean, I heard 90% of it. So basically you're saying he went on stage and did what? He just kind of just... talked about how great he was, or what? I mean,
what? T.J. Miller said. He said, and then last night he got on stage and was vicious,
right,
misogynistic, cruel. He talked about not paying for an abortion. He talked about how girls would do anything for him because, quote, I'm me. He got mad when people were texting. Dane Cook is on stage. He, quote, said, have some fucking respect.
Well,
this
is something funny.
So, what do we think of that?
Well, listen, there are certain comics that reach a level of But here's the thing, though. Now they have to be. I saw one of his shows, you know, on the. It was a nice show, some sort of HBO thing. But I think there's some comics that do their bits. Like, oh man, they're just so polished. They just get on this. They just got these great bits. And then once they hit their crew of people that like, man, Red Fox. I'm talking about a legend. But that man could go on stage at a certain point in his career, or some of the Bill. Oh, what's the Hicks? What's his builder? Is it Bill Hicks? Yeah. Another guy. Okay, they reach this this level playing field where people are just, they're into it, you know? And he could sit there and do that as a statement, and people that are with them are with them. He might have just been reaching, man. I don't know. You know, I mean, fuck, I saw him in Waiting. Was he in Waiting, the movie Waiting? Yeah. That was funny. But, you know, as far as the stand-up, I mean, he's like, is he packing big arenas? Like Dice Clay, the day the laughter died. Okay, you listen to that thing. Just for a gag, just put it on one day when you're on your computer. What was he doing there? He was, you know, but that was, you know, people were, I can't explain it, man. You get to a point where people are with you. It's like in wrestling, man. You're a good guy, and all of a sudden everyone loves you, you know what I mean? And then all of a sudden you turn into a bad guy, but they still love you.
Let me give you Dane's apology, this is an apology.
He worked to get famous. I'm not going to begrudge
he
him.
He said, I'm back in the stand-up octagon after a year off. I'm deeply inspired by various artists I admire. Certainly my friend and one of the great ones, Patrice O'Neill, passed away, has fortified my belief that we as comedians all need to share and explore our souls up there, and sometimes our perspective on the whimsical minutia, in order to grow as artists and people. I've always felt that comedians can't be critics. They can be critical on stage, but it's impossible to be both an artist and a critic. That said, I'm thinking T.J. Miller, the AV Club who reported the story, and I go on a road trip this weekend. I know a terrific spot in Ojai, hydrating facials, double tennis, and a killer 50-minute expectant mother's massage. My treat, I'm really quite rich.
Oh, man. Listen, you can do that. You can do that when people are with you in droves. You know what I mean? When they are with you, you can. It's just like you got to be on top of the top of the top, 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 and have these hardcore people who've been following you for 10 years when you pull this kind of shit. You know what I mean?
You know what, though? I bet Lance is right. I bet if he went out on tour, he'd still sell out arenas. I don't think anyone cares outside of our little comedy bubble.
It's not necessarily saying what I'm saying. I'm just saying that you gotta be on top of it and have people. You gotta be such a talent to pull that off that you are the game. You know what I mean? And I don't see him as the game anymore. I don't know. You know, Mark.
Julia, do you think, since you're not a comedian, so you're on the outside here, Ronnie and Lee and I, we're all in this comedy circle here. Do you think Dane Cook has lost his audience from an outsider's perspective? Do you think people have caught on to him maybe?
I think so, because I've only seen his act once, and that was enough. I just didn't think he was very funny.
Yeah. You think all those movies maybe hurt him, too?
Or not you think he's funny, though, I mean, that's
I mean,
not,
he's
not
obviously got some...
That one of us is going to convince the other.
Right.
Well, I want to hear what Julia has to say about
but
this.
But saying, you know, oh, I'm going for a re-ide on my B-ike, I'm sorry, that's not funny. It's not, and...
But for the people
guys,
that did
you guys
did
know much
find
more
it
intimately.
Funny,
yeah, I know.
Do they not like
for all those college
do you think
jocks?
Maybe
all those
grown,
college jocks. It's like,
do you think they maybe grown out of Dane Cook?
Probably.
And now he's trying a new act.
He could be. He could be to get new. I think that's probably. I think you know, anybody who's an artist has
I
to constantly reinvent
him,
themselves.
I know he was friends with Patrice O'Neill. I get it, but I thought him invoking Patrice's name for his defense and apology was a little
weak.
Yeah, that's weak.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not even offensive. It's just weak.
It is.
And
it's an excuse.
And look, you know, I've seen Patrice's act, and you know what? I can't say I know him as well as Dane and whatever, but I've never heard any stories of Patrice going into clubs and talking like that. I mean, that's just angry.
That's just sad.
Yeah, it's not funny.
It's desperate.
I mean,
it's,
that's something I think even subjectively is not funny.
In fact, that guy that was on your show Monday, what was his name, the other comic? I keep reading his name. I love that guy.
Mark Evan Jackson. Not just really foul-mouthed. It was really brutal towards women. Now, I've heard this kind of stuff sometimes at open mics and stuff. And like I said, I've heard worse. But, like,
right.
This guy's a guy who makes millions going on tour and stuff. I don't see how that helps him. And
well,
I,
you know,
he's trash on women, and I'm not a bleeding heart feminist.
No, but we
know.
Have friends that are.
Right, and that's fine. And I'm like, when you start ripping on women in comedy and just really being harsh, it's not funny anymore. It just shows that, first of all, you're scared shitless of women. And if you were confronted with a clitoris, you wouldn't know what the fuck to do. And yeah. It's just, it's a bullshit. And you know, of course, it's okay to make fun of people in general. But when you really start digging in, it's not funny.
You
it's
make
like,
Dice
ooh, cringing,
Clay.
Cringing.
You make
ooh,
Dice
cringing.
Clay look like Paula Poundstone
yeah.
with what he's saying.
I don't
yeah.
know. It's,
you know, you bring up Dice Clay, and I appreciate Dice Clay's what he's doing now more than ever, which is nothing. You know what I'm saying? He's like, just because of what he's done, I don't know how women even went to his shows, to be honest with you.
I did one.
Well, nobody had...
Wait, Julia went to a Dice show. I want
to
hear that.
I was in college in Madison, Wisconsin, and he was in town, and somebody said, hey, do you want to go? I think it was in Madison. Yeah, I think...
Okay.
Yeah. And it was hey, fiddle, diddle, whatever the fuck.
Right.
Nobody
like,
Nobody laughs at his show, so if you look at the audience.
So
like,
you know,
no, the only people who were laughing were the men.
Okay, so
well, then the women
laugh.
Were like,
how many women
were,
fuck,
what
was the ratio of women to men?
I would say I'd say 80% men, 20%
okay.
I mean, it was...
And the women were obviously there maybe with guys.
Yeah,
just
on dates or something.
Very few just to
yeah.
check him out or whatever,
yeah.
and they were
yeah.
just appalled.
Yeah.
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 Yeah, I believe it.
Yeah, it was not funny.
Men loved him though.
He was I liked Dice on Entourage though. The small part that he had, I thought he was pretty good because I think he was basically playing himself.
Ronnie,
he's a total dick.
Ronnie, do you watch Entourage?
No, you know, it's something I should. I'm in love with that guy. What's the guy's name? The agent guy. I keep forgetting his name. I'm not bad with names.
You're an Ari Gold fan?
It's about and brought some Jeremy Piven love to this show. So go ahead.
Jeremy, listen, that guy is a talent, man. He's so sharp. I can't explain it. He's just got such a rhythm to him. You know, whatever. He's just fucking great.
He is now.
Well, you know, he was very good in that role.
Uh-huh.
And I've liked him in other things.
I saw him in a movie with, what's his name, that other comic, the blonde guy, driving a Cadillac, throwing cheeseburgers out of the road, Dennis Leary. Leary. He was in a movie with Dennis Leary or something. And kind of the same role, but man, he really nails it. I just think he's a great talent. It's just unreal how good he is.
Well, you know what, Ronnie? I'll give you that. You like him. What movies have you seen lately, Ronnie, that are, like, really good? What have you been playing late at night over there?
Ronnie, what did you think of The Artist?
Yeah, The Artist.
I didn't see it. You know, what did we watch last night? Listen, this is how adolescent and mindless I am. We put on, like, The Jerk with Steve Martin. And we did 30 Days Tonight, which was some horror film. Listen, the people that come in here, their minds are so small. They're just so tiny, you know. They just love that shit.
You know what? You have a great customer base because they're talking. You're talking about how tiny all your customers' minds are. Boy, they gotta love you, Ronnie.
Well, whatever. I fit right in. Hey, I want to point one thing out though. There was Rodney Dangerfield.
Yes.
Had a show. You know, some sort of show. And I remember seeing Dice Clay when he first came out. There was Sam Kinison was on this show. There was a couple other comics. Whatever. My point was. Dice Clay's bits were not what they evolved into in the beginning. They were sharp. He was good looking. He was charming. He was odd. He was slightly rude. You know what I mean? He wasn't completely
special. He was actually pretty normal.
Yeah.
No, I mean, how sharp? How sharp could you possibly have been to get on that Rodney Dangerfield show? He was right on the cutting edge of coming out of the box. And I just want to point out that at one time, that was a classy, sharp, good looking. You know what I mean?
I think in a Cicero Berwin way, he was really good looking.
But he was so charming that he knew just the line before he crossed it. You know what I mean? Maybe it was because it was for that show. They put some guidelines on it. But I think he evolved into this, you know, this real creep later because that seemed to be the people he was catering to. They kind of, it's like, you know, you're on stage, you kind of go fishing. You throw out drugs, you throw out sex, you throw out school and whatever they nibble at, you go for. I think the majority of the people in the audience that were watching him started to go, oh, you know, we like this dirty, naughty, rhyming bullshit. He just went with it because I don't know why.
Yeah, and he progressively got more offensive, too, which I think helped him for a while. And then he just started crossing lines that people weren't comfortable with.
It's obviously what the people wanted, you know? I mean, like Sam Kinison did that whole thing with Jessica Hahn and all that weird stuff. Yeah, I remember seeing Kinison on Sunset Strip. It was me, this Mexican girl I was dating and two people in the audience, and he did the full-blown show. I'm not kidding with you. I'm just sitting there staring at Sam Kinison screaming at me. It's like five of us. I was like, man, this guy's got energy.
Yeah. You love Sam Kinison, Ronnie.
I love Sam Kinison, too.
Ronnie, was Sam Kinison like your guy? I had to imagine you loved him.
You know what? I really liked what he was doing, you know? I mean, I don't know. It's almost like, who's the guy that does the impersonation of him? And he calls up to Sam Kinison, he calls up radio shows, I'm Sam Kinison, I'm in hell.
Yeah, I think it's Craig Gatt. Yeah, you're right.
Jesus. The impersonations of him are incredible, and they're funny. You know, and it just it brings you back to, like, man, that was when comedy was at, like, some sort of weird peak of, like, man, these people have something to offer. They all had different styles. Dice had his. Sam had his. You know, I mean, I listened to Red Fox on the Brown Plain Rapper the other day. What a sharp storyteller. You know, I think that's missing, you know, in comedy today. But why am I being so opinionated? Anyway, my point is, you can't pull that kind of shit off like Red Fox did unless they're with you. You know, you can't go out and tell a story. You got to get them. Whatever. Those people got them, is my point.
I agree, and that's what I love about Cigars and Stripes. People are out of their minds, and they already feel like they got them.
Right.
Well, I'm finding it getting a little bit more structured here as time goes on.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah. Are you still getting 15 comics and 2.5 hour open mics on Wednesdays,
right,
Ronnie?
Well, you know, here's my theory. You know, a kid called this morning and said, look, I'm going to get on stage. I said, fine, come on out. How long do I get? I said, listen, I'm going to let you go until you burn, okay? So just have something to say and get up there. And that's the thing, and I'm probably repeating myself, but about open mics anywhere, California, I don't know, New York, wherever they do them, they always have some guy there with a lighter kicking these people off in 2.5 minutes. The problem is you have absolutely no time to let their character evolve at all. So how do I even know that this guy, you know, all right, typical example, lives in his parents' basement, takes the bus to school, you know, we don't know anything about him, so what he has to say in the first 3 minutes means nothing. You know what I mean? So I tend to let them go here until they burn. I like to look, if you're hot and you're on fire, go, but don't reach for that last one. Lead them high and get off my stage, you know what I mean? Just go.
Well, Ronnie, do you have anything else left to promote and stuff? I know Joe Carnahan's in the building, the director of The Gray, the writer of The Gray. I want you to see this movie because I even said to Lee last week, this is a Ronnie Lotz movie.
It's a good flick, Ronnie.
Let me tell you something, man. This is like freaking best work in the 70s. That's how good this movie is. This is some of his best work. I'm telling you, if this film came out a month ago, it would have been nominated for an Oscar. It's fantastic.
Well, where do I get it?
No, it's in theaters Friday, The Gray.
Good. I'll go see it. If I ever get out of this building, man, I want to go see it. I saw the trailer. It looks really good.
I got to tell you, Ronnie, it's the best movie I've seen in months. Probably since...
Obviously filled with action, you know.
It does have action, but it's
got Liam Neeson.
I'm telling you, it has a great 70s vibe to it. And I don't mean that in any offensive way. I mean the best movies of the 70s. Like, that was the best decade for film. Julia, would you?
I think so.
As a film person,
yeah. I think it's one of the best.
And this just reminded me a little of William Friedkin, a little Walter Hill.
Yep.
But it has Joe Carnahan's stamp all over it, and it's great. It's really, really good. And
I'm going to run and go see it.
And the action's great with the wolves and stuff, but I got to tell you, man, the writing is outstanding. It's not... Dude, he just knew how to balance it perfectly. It's a great movie. I'm telling you. See it. It's rated R. You're going to get a little blood. You're going to get a little fun. It's a good movie, though.
What's wrong with that?
Yeah. I mean, it's better than Underworld that came out last week. I hope people stop seeing that and go see this.
Well, they're still making that. Listen, guys, I appreciate you guys calling me. You know what I mean? And I'm so glad that you guys have hooked up. And Julia, I'm on odd delay again, so it's very difficult for me to talk to you guys. But Julia, nice to meet you. And if I ever come to Los Angeles, I will say hello to all of you.
Absolutely.
Anytime, Ronnie. You know I'll call you soon. You're the best. Cigars and Stripes, Wednesday night. We have open mic night tonight. I say we because I feel like that is my home. I love cigars.
Oh, I know.
It's the best wings that you will have in the city. Good beer. Good American beer.
Yeah.
Hey, listen, I appreciate you guys calling in. Thank you so much, and I'll talk to you soon.
You're the best, buddy. I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks, Ronnie.
Thanks for the warning.
All right. Bye.
Goodbye.
All right, Julia, we're going to say adieu.
Yeah, that's fine.
See the gray? I'm telling you. I've been talking about it on Facebook.
Well,
I know. I leaked it out.
Anything that has my name in it, the gray.
Yes.
I have to see.
Yeah, Julia the gray.
The gray. That's me.